Hello, and welcome to the Science and/or Fiction Podcast. I'm Taylor Sloan.
And I'm Lucas Moore.
Lucas, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a scientist. I like science fiction, but I am primarily in my day job, I'm a scientist. I do chemistry. I'm a process chemist. I got my PhD at the end of 2019, right before everything kind of hit the fan. And I've been doing chemistry research for about, in the industry for about 6 years. Taylor, how about you?
Well, I am not a scientist in the conventional sense or any sense, really. I'm a flight medic and a huge science fiction nerd and aspiring quasi-science fiction writer. And Lucas, this isn't the first time we've done this podcast, is it?
No, of course not. And obviously, we've done, let's say, a non-recorded ad hoc version of this podcast probably once every other day for 2 or 3 years in college. And we're taking the time to actually record it this time.
Yeah. And so basically this podcast, if you didn't listen to our previous iteration, 6 years ago, is a podcast about science and about science fiction and about anything that fits in between those two categories. One thing, just a couple of housekeeping notes that I want to hit on before we get too far, because I know, you might be listening to the first time and thinking, ugh, two white guys with microphones again. Just want to cover a couple things. First of all, we know the world kind of sucks right now, and we can't necessarily fix that with a podcast, but we can give you something enjoyable to listen to, and we believe that there are still things in the world worth enjoying. Science can be worth enjoying. Science fiction can be worth enjoying. Second, as far as our values, we are not necessarily, conservatives by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, we're both pretty left of center. And this is a podcast that will be friendly and for the queer community and for people who are feminists. And we will not tolerate from any fans or in any of the things that we cover any kind of hate, chauvinism, racism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just getting that out there.
One of my favorite parts of science fiction is that it can describe these terrible dystopian worlds, but there's always some spark. There's always some really great thing about it. And science fiction is often a mirror held up to what's happening in the world. And one of the ways that some of my favorite science fiction behaves that way is in a world that is terrible, and yet there is hope, and even some fun. And so, yeah, we're recording right now in late January of 2026. It's a mess out there, folks. But part of why we're really wanting to talk about all this is because there is good in the world, there's fun in the world, and there's interesting stuff happening. And it's okay not to completely focus on the terrible stuff all the time.
Yeah, I would say, like you said, science fiction gives us an opportunity to have hope, even in some, absolutely perfect literary dystopias. So in the world we live in now, it's something I think we need even more. And on that note, this episode, which we've been trying to record for the last couple of weeks, but have had endless technical difficulties, is going to be sort of a look back at 2025 and the things that we enjoyed or thought were cool about 2025, and then looking forward into 2026 and what things we're looking forward to about that. So, Lucas, if you'd like to kick it off, why don't you tell me about the Nobel Prizes in Chemistry?
Yeah, so every year, the Nobel Committee in Stockholm gives out the Nobel Prize, and there's a lot of different Nobel Prizes, but as a chemist, the one that I pay attention to the most is the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. This year, the Nobel Prize went to a trio of chemists who developed and really got working for the first time things called metal organic frameworks. These things are really cool. If you're not a chemist, you may have never even heard of them. But they are fantastic, almost science fiction-like objects. Effectively, they are things that will increase the surface area of an object to just an absolute ridiculous amount. If you imagine taking like a cube and you can measure the surface area of that cube, if you drill a hole in it, now you've increased the surface area because now you have like a little bit of like a little cylinder that is on the inside of it. If you drill a million little holes, now you have way more surface area. metal organic frameworks are effectively things that have molecular sized holes in them, and they have just a ridiculous amount of surface area.
Interesting. So kind of like an organic molecule, but metal?
Yeah, so the metal organic thing is because if the main structure, most of these things are made out of organic molecules. Okay. They're like little chains, and imagine a short little chain with two kind of grippers on the ends, and those grippers will grab onto metal ions or metal centers.
Okay.
And so if you have two or three of these chains that grab onto a metal center, you can imagine making kind of a grid out of these things. Like imagine, I don't know, Tinker Toys or the kinds of playground equipment you might play on when you're a kid. They make a grid, and those grids are on the order of a few dozen angstroms, like, you know, millions of meters to a side.
So what would be like some practical applications of that potentially?
Yeah, the number of research papers coming out on MOFs is just like going through, MOFs, metal organic frameworks, is going through the roof, because a lot of them, they're really, really useful for anything that happens on a surface, given their ridiculous surface area. So for the world at large, I think the most interesting things are in the field of gas storage. So a lot of times if you want to put a bunch of gas into like a cylinder or a tank or something like that, you have to compress it way down. You're under a lot of pressure. It's an engineering challenge. But gases have a way of adhering to surfaces. And they do that in all surfaces, no matter what, but often you don't have that much surface area. So the effect isn't that large. If you have a metal organic framework and you tune the organic molecules just right, you can get gases to stick to those surfaces quite well. And effectively, you can fill a tank with a metal organic framework, pump a bunch of gas into it, and store lots and lots of gas at a comparatively low pressure to what you would if you didn't have that metal organic framework there.
Oh, okay.
So hydrogen storage would probably be the most obvious thing to go with.
Like for fuel cells.
Exactly, yeah. If we're going to drive cars that aren't going to be pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere all the time, hydrogen is an option. It's not the best option. It's not the best option for every scenario, but there are some where hydrogen would be pretty good. And a tank full of a metal organic framework that's tuned to bind hydrogen would be really great compared to just a big dumb tank full of high-pressure hydrogen.
Interesting. Okay. Very cool.
Now, Taylor.
Yes.
You've got things that you want to talk about in 2025.
I do.
Please tell me about a very cool movie that was released in 2025. Tell me about Superman.
Yeah. So Superman 2025, that's not the name of the movie, but you know, everybody thinks of movies
convention.
And as superhero movies in particular as the superhero movie plus the year, because there's so many iterations of them. But this version of Superman, which came out this last year, made by James Gunn, who has made a lot of other superhero things and fun things like that. But it, you know, it was a very different kind of superhero movie than we've gotten lately. And I think there were a lot of things in that regard about it that were kind of enjoyable. I think the first thing about it that you notice immediately, because it just kind of starts you in the middle of a battle, is that it's not an origin story. Everybody knows who Superman is. Everybody knows where he came from. Everybody knows that he grew up in Kansas and that he's an alien, and that, like, everybody knows that about Superman. To do another, you know, origin story of Superman, like origin stories of superheroes have just been beaten into the bush. And so
no,
it just
Taylor,
kind of
I don't
like,
think
hey,
I've ever heard the origin story of Superman. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I'm not going to tell you. You're just going to have to go figure it out on your own. There's plenty of movies and TV shows that you could do that. But like, it's just nice that, you know, there's something refreshing about the way that James Gunn treats the audience, that like, he's like, yeah, I know, you know who Superman is. We're just going to kind of, you know, get into it. I'm not going to waste your time. And it allows the entire, you know, however long the movie is, I should have that probably right in front of me, but I don't. It's a normal length movie, maybe a little bit longer than 2 hours. It is much more packed with actual action and more meat of the story of what's happening. So it brings back...
If you're in like a Greek tragedy, nobody ever has to explain to you who Heracles is. They just go ahead and say, here's Heracles. Yep. You know who he is.
We know
this guy. Let's watch him do some stuff.
He's been in so many other, you know, staged tragedies that you've seen at this amphitheater. Lex Luthor is the bad guy. You know, classic. I think everybody knows who Lex Luthor is, at least knows that he's the bald, you know, technocrat bad guy in Superman. And he hates Superman with a passion for seemingly no reason. And I think that he went a really great direction with this, which is that basically he made Lex Luthor a tech bro. Like he's the CEO of, you know, Luthor Corp, this massive corporation, and he is super racist and xenophobic. He hates aliens. He knows that Superman is an alien, like, and it is sort of this, you know, framework that can be very much seen as like a, you know, commentary on immigration, which is obviously a big deal right now. And I think making Lex Luthor the bad guy, this basically Elon Musk, but if he was smart, I think is the way you put it when we talked about the movie for the first time.
Yeah, doesn't Lex Luthor know that you can get hair plugs these days?
Yeah, right. And going back to Star Trek The Next Generation, when that little girl asked Patrick Stewart why he wouldn't have gotten his bald hair cured in the 24th century, said, well, why would you think that people in the 24th century would care? Also, I'm bald, so I don't take that personally at all. going back to Superman, I think one of my favorite things about it, too, was that it felt more like the Superman of the early comics, who was this friend of the common man raised by, you know, lower middle class farmers in Kansas. And he, you know, punched Nazis and fought coal barons and was like the good guy of the working people, right? And it feels like the Superman in this story is that way too.
I think one of my favorite parts of this too is just that they made him feel like a real person, and actually all the characters in this movie certainly felt like real, honest people that have real conversations. When I saw, there's a particular conversation relatively early on in the movie between Clark and Lois, and I saw people talking online that said, yeah, the person who wrote that scene, their parents got a divorce. Like, they know what that looks like.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's much more realistic depictions of human beings in the scenarios of this movie. And I think that just is so refreshing in a world where everything has to be these massively dramatic, unbelievable, you know, conversations, fights, whatever, between characters who are supposed to be friends. And also, I think one of the great things about this movie is that Lois Lane, who is played by Rachel Brosnahan, is very much the hero of this movie as well. Like, she arguably does just as much to, you know, save the day as Superman Clark Kent does. And, you know, there's just something that's really cool about that. Like, she's not a superhero. She's a regular person like us, but she is a incredibly heroic and valuable part of what good happens in this movie. And even so, like, convinces other superheroes in the movie who are kind of being shitheads to be like, hey, why don't you come and like do your jobs, and like basically says, well, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it, and gets them to do it. And on that note, I will say one of my favorite things about this movie that's not necessarily plot related is that both Alan Tudyk and Nathan Fillion are in the movie. Not big spoilers, but you notice there's one of the Superman's robots in the Fortress of Solitude is voiced by Alan Tudyk. And like, I immediately clocked it when we were sitting in the movie theater, my wife and I watching the movie, and was like, wait a minute, that's Alan Tudyk. And then of course Nathan Fillion shows up as Green Lantern. And I just think it's nice that James Gunn adopted Alan Tudyk and Nathan Fillion together and is their dad now. Now that Joss Whedon's kind of a piece of shit. So I'm happy to see them, you know, together in funny roles in a movie again.
There are certain directors, certain writers that will sort of adopt a cast that they go back to over and over. you have the Wes Anderson people, you know, you have, well, there's many examples. It would be nice if this crew sort of stuck together, not necessarily playing the same characters over and over, but, you know, they almost like an old style acting troupe.
Yeah, I mean, that is, I think, one of the nice things. And so you come to, like, get to know certain actors that will usually play, like, certain parts. But yeah, that's Superman, a.k.a. Superman 2025. Very good. All right, if you haven't seen it, go find a place to watch it.
Yeah, this is our first film review. Do we do thumbs up? Do we do two Spock hands up? Like, what's the plan?
I think we'll just tell you if the movie's bad or good. How about that?
Okay.
Because Superman 2025. I am not a certified, listen, Metacritic would eat me alive. So I am not a certified movie reviewer by any stretch of the imagination. But yeah, it was a great movie. I'd say go watch it. Okay, yeah, and then on
totally agreed.
On that note, Lucas, why don't you tell me about another thing that will not necessarily be a review, but something that you enjoyed? Tell me about Murderbot.
Yeah, I'm one of those people who pays for the silly Apple bundle, and so I get, you know, various perks with that. But one of them, it comes with Apple TV, and so every once in a while, I will go and flip through Apple TV and see if they've made anything new. They make some good stuff. They make some bad stuff. But last year, I watched through the first season of Murderbot. It is based on a series of books by Martha Wells, which after I finished the first season, I went out and bought all of those books. That should be a review enough. But the pitch of the movie or the series is, what if a killer robot gained sentience and decided not to be a killer robot, except it's funny. It's set in a corpo dystopian future that is still somewhat socially progressive, at least amongst some factions of people. It's really fun. It's difficult for me to tell much more about the show without giving away a lot. But it has a lot of heart. And the characters are really compelling.
Okay, now, question, have you read the books?
I haven't yet. That is a problem with me. I read a lot fewer books now than I did when I was younger. I'm busy and my brain is made of scrambled eggs, but the show is quite good. And at the very least, you know, I like when a book series gets turned into another piece of media and I really enjoy it, I find it... it feels good to go and buy those books, even if I'm never going to read them. It's nice to sort of throw the author a few bucks and say, hey, thank you for making the base material that turned into something good.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. So fair warning for me, too. I also started reading the book around late May, early June of this last year. And then June 10th, I had a baby. And so there were a lot of things that I were doing at the beginning of June that just did not really
you just
carry
have
through.
So much free time.
I have a lot more now that she's almost 8 months old, but at the beginning, not to get too off topic here, but basically my wife and I kind of came up with this explanation for other people who don't have babies of like what the newborn stage of having a baby is like. Mm-hmm. And it's basically like a liminal space, like you're on airport time. Plus it was also, you know, I live in Indianapolis and it was pretty consistently over like 87 degrees, basically from the time we brought our daughter home to, I think late November. I'm not totally sure. It was so hot. So humid. We couldn't get outside and do anything, especially with a baby. Like I would go out and mow the lawn and like go to the grocery store and that was about it. But yeah, it's sort of like a weird liminal space where you don't really remember anything. And, yeah, it kind of feels like being in a weird sort of like alternate universe airport where you're not really sure where you're going or if you have tickets for something or just really what's going on. And it, you know, honestly, the baby, 10 out of 10, recommend. The experience of having a newborn, 0 out of 10, do not recommend.
So funny you should say that. A lot of the setting of this show is mostly confined to a base on a planet very far away, and feels a little bit like that. There's definitely hostile stuff outside the base. Inside the base, it's always safe. And then there's this person that is with the crew, and this person is the star of the show, who is one of the Skarsgårds, who is definitely a human and definitely does not quite act like the rest of them in various ways. So it's not quite like having a baby in the base, but it's a little bit like that.
Interesting. Lucas, pop quiz. How many Skarsgårds are there?
Enough.
Yeah, agreed.
Let's see. There's the Dune one.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know what? Truth be told, I'm not sure I could tell you the first name of this particular Skarsgård.
Is it Stellan? Is this Stellan one? Because the Dune one was also the Tesseract guy in the Avengers movies.
Yeah, you know what?
But I think there's at least three of them, because there was the It one too.
And then there's the Elder Skarsgård as well.
Yeah.
Is also very good.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So my recommendation is that if you have Apple TV and or you know somebody who will let you borrow their password, go give it a watch. If you watch the first episode and you don't like it, you're probably not going to like the rest, and that's fine. But if you like the first episode, consider watching it through. It's got a really great story. You can kind of see where it's going, but in a way that makes you feel smart. And it takes a couple twists, so I enjoy it quite a lot.
Okay. Well, as someone with an Apple TV password, I will give that a check out.
Okay. So we were talking about books and reading, and I would like to hear, Taylor, your pitch for the most recent work from an author that we both quite enjoy, QNTM, Sam Hughes. Tell me about the Anti-Mimetics Division.
Yes. Well, okay. Let's back up a little bit. Let's talk about who Sam Hughes, QNTM Quantum, is. He is a British author, writer, mathematician, nerd. And he writes, I would describe it as very cerebral sci-fi. So there are a couple of things that we have both read of his that are both available as... like on his website, just to read like sequentially as different chapters, as blog posts. The first one that I read that you recommended to me was called Fine Structure. And it's almost hard to describe. I also haven't read it in a very long time, but Lucas, can you try to describe Fine Structure? And then I will think about how to describe Raw, and then we can talk about Anti-Mimetics Division, just because I think it's important to understand his writing style, if I'm going to pitch this to you.
Sure. So Fine Structure is, it started off as a series of short stories on his website that, as it turned out, were totally interconnected. But it follows a group of people and kind of humanity as a whole as they deal with the fact that there are a couple of very, very advanced, very deadly, super intelligent aliens that have come down from a higher dimension to be amongst people. And the consequences of that are quite far reaching. But effectively, one of them is the good guy. One of them is the bad guy. And there is an extra dimensional, basically prison guard that every time the bad guy tries to break out, the prison guard will shut off that way of getting out. And usually that means taking some kind of technology and making it not work anymore, changing the laws of physics to keep the bad guy in. Now, that is a very, very simplistic way of looking at it. It gets very interesting. Towards the end, you kind of realize that if you have two hyper-intelligent alien beings who are fighting, it doesn't really matter which one's the good guy and which one's the bad guy.
Everybody if below you loses, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The ants do not care if the Nazi or the Allied soldier wins on the battlefield above them if they get stepped on.
Right.
And so again, a ridiculous oversimplification. It's got a lot of really cool ideas, but this is what really sucked me into, a different kind of sci-fi.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I remember, you shared it with me and I basically compiled it all together as an EPUB book to read before he released them as EPUBs. And yeah, it just kind of broke my brain in a really good way. So similarly, Raw, spelled R-A, like the like the Egyptian god slash Goa'uld. It basically, the plot of the book is, what if magic was real? So it's set in, like, you know, modern times, in sort of an alternate version of the world that is not super dissimilar from our own, with the exception that magic has been discovered and is being utilized for all kinds of sort of sciencey things and non-sciencey things. And there's this character who is a student of, like, a science student of magic, basically, whose mom was an astronaut that was killed by a magic spacecraft, basically, blowing up. And so it is the story of her coming to understand what magic really is. And again, I don't even really want to give you spoilers for this, even though this is like a, I don't know, 10, 15 year old book at this point, but it is very good to read. I will say before, again, even if I start into Antimimetics Division, both of those two are available as full books from his website, which is qntm.org, and highly recommend. You can read them there. You can get EPUBs or like physical copies, whatever.
Tell he's like an old school internet person because he got a 4-letter domain name.
yeah, he got a really, really quick start on that, and I'm a little bit jealous, honestly. I got a .me TLD for my, anyway. So there is no Antimimetics Division. Started out as one of those kind of serialized, like, blog posts at a time as a chapter, and it sort of started as a, I don't know if you've heard of, like, the SCP Wiki, Secure, Contain, Protect, is a collaborative science fiction horror wiki, basically, that tells the stories of all of these SCP items, creatures, whatever, and each SCP number is a different item, species, creature, something that is very bizarre and potentially dangerous, and that this SCP Foundation is this, you know, multinational, shadowy, extra-governmental organization has been, you know, created to secure, contain, and protect. So there is no Antimimetics Division. It isn't necessarily set in that SCP universe, but very much similarly, there is a big shadowy extra-governmental organization that is created to deal with those kinds of things. And it's really hard to kind of set this up because I don't want to spoil any part of it.
Okay, so I haven't read it, but yeah. Taylor, I will tell you what I know based on on his earlier work. So there's a concept in Fine Structure where he sort of introduces this idea of an anti-meme or anti-memetics, where it's an idea, so a meme in the old way of talking about it, not an internet image macro, but instead an idea that is self-reinforcing. Yes. So a meme is something that, the more people believe it, the more it spreads, the more it spreads, the more people believe it. An anti-meme or anti-memetics would be sort of the opposite of that, meaning an idea that is sort of self-destructive, and that as soon as it gets into the world, it is deleted by some mechanism. I'm guessing that this Antimimetics Division goes after monsters or whatever, horrors that are very hard to nail down because nobody can remember that they're there.
Yeah, basically. That's where I would say you should go into it. That's as much as you can understand going into it. It will kind of, that understanding of it will change slightly, but generally speaking, that is kind of the overarching story of it. But yeah, the idea of essentially, you know, a big bad who is a thing that cannot be understood, explained. You can't draw a picture of it. You can't write its name down. Anybody who sees it can't tell you what it looks like. And what that means in terms of trying to, you know, manage that, keep the world safe, whatever. But it tells the stories of some different people, but one particular agent who is sort of the protagonist of the book is like trying to figure this all out and like put all these pieces together while not being able to remember various parts of it. And so it gets very cerebral about how do you deal with something you cannot remember, you cannot see. Well, you can see it, but then you might as well have not seen it. Seeing it makes you unsee it. It is anti-mimetic. And that is the very sort of the foundational aspect of this book. So if you
going
are
into it, should I Should I prepare for the protagonist? Are they more of a Mulder or a Scully?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to say more of a Scully, obviously. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, that's fair to say. I'll give you that. Okay. But yeah, it's there is very much like an X-Files-esque sort of quality to it, which I think is kind of like what SCP, you know, sort of came out of, that same genre of like weird horror, maybe is the right word. It's very good. It is very cerebral. It is not the kind of book I could have read 7 months ago and remembered any of. So in that way, it could have been anti-mimetic in its own regard. It turns out everything is anti-mimetic when you're getting 2 hours of sleep every night, if you're lucky.
Oh, man. Secure, contain, protect your infant child.
Yeah, exactly. So last thing, I feel like, you know, a lot of what we're... that was kind of our last thing for stuff for 2025, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's start off with the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. Tell me about this, because it is very cool.
Yeah, so probably late 2026, we are going to see the launch of the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. This thing is going to be awesome. All right, so it is like Hubble. It's mostly going to be in the visible range of imaging. The James Webb Space Telescope that launched relatively recently is not in the visible range for most of it. It's in the infrared. For the Nancy Grace Roman, we're mostly going to be looking at visible range stuff. So things that you could see with your naked eye if you had very, very, very good eyes. It's not going to be in low Earth orbit or medium Earth orbit like Hubble is. It's not going to be out at the Sun-Earth Lagrange point. So the field of view that's going to be able to get is going to be a lot better, because the Earth isn't going to be in the way for most of it, and it can look at just about anything for any length of time. Although servicing it will be much more difficult. we can't have a cool, you know, Canadian astronaut with a guitar go up there and service it.
Yeah, that's a little harder place to get to. That's kind of like you drop it off and hope it works well.
Yes, we'll have to make sure Ball gets the mirror right on the first try this time. Yeah.
That would be important. So
it will be able to pick out similar detail level to Hubble. So as far as like resolution and arc seconds and stuff, but it can see about 100 times more area of sky at a time. So Hubble is really, really great at pointing at something and getting really up in up close to it. Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope will be able to get that level of detail, but for a very large portion of the sky at a time. So this will make looking for things like exoplanets, or, you know, potentially that elusive Planet 9 we keep all looking for, or whatever. It will make looking for that kind of stuff a lot easier. So the only thing I'm worried about with Nancy Grace Roman, and again, we said we wouldn't talk too much about the terrible things that are happening in the world, but the current people running the executive branch don't want to send science things into space. It's a good thing, and it's going into space, so they want to kill it. But fortunately, Congress seems to like it, and so does the new NASA administrator. So I have a good feeling that Nancy Grace Roman at least won't be, you know, stripped down for parts. It might have to sit in a warehouse until we get our act together. But there's a very good chance it's actually going to launch in 2026.
That would be awesome. I think, we kind of need any wins that we can get right now in terms of like cool things still happening here. And I think obviously space is one of those areas where, you know, politics very much is involved in what is allowed to happen, but the people actually doing the work seem to be a lot less politically motivated, because, I mean, we still have so much cooperation between like Roscosmos and NASA and, you know, the Chinese Space Agency and Japanese Space Agency and ESA. And like, even though, you know, everybody else politically in those governments are all at each other's throats, we still get to do cool shit in space together. So yeah, that's cool.
There's definitely a camaraderie amongst scientists where, you talk to a scientist, it kind of doesn't matter what their background is. We all, there's a convergent evolution that happens where scientists often have very similar ways of looking at the world. And we like to think that it's the right way of looking at the world, of course, but there's a camaraderie there that transcends politics when it's allowed to.
I mean, there's something about, having to test any theory that you have and have that test be repeatable by others that kind of reinforces, I think, maybe a little bit better worldview in some way.
Reality has a particular kind of bias in that way.
Yeah, it sort of does.
Okay, so more predictions for 2026. Taylor, you've got some ideas about where, like, what the visual world is going to look like in 2026.
Yeah, so this is kind of a weird one, and I have really struggled with how to articulate my feelings about this, but it's sort of this weird prediction I have for, like, society and culture in the near future, and it was spurred on by talking to one of my friends who works in the corporate world, and they were telling me about how, you know, they're relatively new corporation, like, was a part of, like, the startup boom of the early 2000s, and has these, like, cutesy little mascots, like cartoon mascots. They're going to be, like, doing away with that. And that I feel like there's this sort of thing with, like, corporate culture and the way that corporations interact with the world over the last 20 years with, like, the startups and the second big internet bubble and everything, where it's been, like, very, like, colorful and cutesy and fun and enjoyable, and, like, you know, that corporations aren't these evil dark entities, which of course they have always been, despite the facades. But I think, like, because of maybe some political things and economic things, it seems like those corporations are kind of moving away from trying to be cartoonish in any way and are kind of moving towards these sort of more, like, corporate dystopian, dark, bleak sort of marble and slate and maybe, like, evil art deco kind of.
Sure. When I think about dark and gritty corporate sort of aesthetics, I think about, like, Blade Runner, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of in that cyberpunk aesthetic. But when you're talking about, like, slate and metal, it's not quite cyberpunk, right? It's definitely something else.
Yeah. We could do an entire episode on this, probably should at some point, but, like, the idea of, like, X, you know, blank punk, is that it is a cultural resistance against a thing that's happening. So, like, solar punk is a cultural resistance against, you know, a world of, you know, increasing, like, resource demand and, like, unchecked capitalism destroying the world. And so it's not necessarily, like, solar punk is the opposite of cyberpunk, because cyberpunk is, like, using those, like, cybernetic implants and technology against the man and, like, you know, I don't want to give it, like, a punk, blank punk description, but just the sort of, like...
Sure, because it's coming from a different, it's not a bottom-up sort of situation.
Yeah, no. It is definitely not. It's a top-down thing. I think whatever it is, corporations have no longer feel the need to be warm and welcoming to people anymore, which I think is, like, sort of a thing that we can kind of view through the lens of, like, what that's looked like in science fiction. And so, yeah, like, cyberpunk definitely is a part of that. But also, there's a movie that I'm thinking of specifically, Equilibrium, that is about this world where there is no art, there is no emotion. Like, everybody has to take a pill every day to basically make their emotion go away. And they enjoy nothing, they hate nothing, they are just existing and productive. And that sort of, like, aesthetic of that world, of, like, everything is just, like, these very brutalist buildings, and why would anything be colorful? We don't have the emotions to experience that in any meaningful way, and sort of, like, yeah, everything's going to be kind of black and white in that way. And I think that that's maybe not the best thing, but it's interesting, and it's something that I've been noticing, and, you know, I wanted to make kind of a more predictive prediction than just, like, yeah, this seems likely, but, like, this maybe could happen. I could be right. I could also be wrong. It's a prediction. We'll see.
I remember, and this was actually around the time that we were in college, but there was in the early 2010s and a little before, but there was a lot of moving to what we would call things that are dark and gritty. There was a lot of grays, a lot of desaturated stuff. there seemed to be, we went through a phase where everything was grim and dirty and there wasn't a lot of color, and we didn't really start getting color back into design. And I'm thinking a lot about like software UI design, but that didn't really start coming back until quite a bit later. Maybe, I don't know, the early or the mid 2010s, like in the 2017, 2018 is when I remember it, kind of that resurgence of it. I hope that if we go into a sort of dark and gritty phase, it doesn't last very long. That was kind of a bummer.
Yeah, no, it's a huge bummer, but also like, you know, maybe there's something good to sort of the capitalist hellscape that we live in, looking a little bit more like a capitalist hellscape in terms of maybe getting people to see that it is a capitalist hellscape. It remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's not like the giant business doesn't want to give you a hug. It just wants you to buy a new phone.
Exactly. Yeah. And they don't, they're not pretending to be your friend anymore. They own you. They want you to know that they own you. They don't want to pretend like they're just looking out for your best interests. They just straight up own you. Speaking of weird, I don't actually know if capitalism is what was happening, but some sort of weird feudalism. Tell me about Dune 3.
Right. So over the last couple of years, we've had a, film adaptations of Frank Herbert's Dune. I think they've been quite good and actually relatively true to the source material, at least as true as you can be to have a successful film franchise. I did not expect that they were going to be doing a third film. It's going to be based on Dune Messiah, and I think that is going to get really, really weird.
Yes.
I think a lot of people understand, or at least through cultural osmosis, understand Dune. If you say Dune, people will be like, oh, the spice must flow. And yeah, okay. Dune Messiah gets real rough. So have you read Dune Messiah?
Yes, have you? I read Dune Messiah, a long time ago. But I know, so it's set after Dune. So, okay, so the confusing thing to me, too, when I think about this, too, is there's two movies, Dune 1 and Dune 2, that cover the entirety of Dune, the first book. Mm-hmm. Dune Messiah is the second book, and the third movie will be presumably the first part of Dune Messiah, because Dune Messiah is also a pretty lengthy book. But,
right.
Yeah, Dune Messiah, it's set after Dune. Paul is the emperor of everything, of humanity. And all of
Fremen
his followers...
Have killed,
yeah, basically kill the better part of... everybody, like they go and wage a brutal war in his name, and everybody hates him and are conspiring against him.
Right, and you've got other, let's say, challenging ideas. Yes, it's science fiction, but people I don't think are going to expect to see like weird semi-clone people, like based on the future history of what's going on in the books. At least I think Jason Momoa has a job for quite a while.
He does come back. spoilers, sorry. Duncan Idaho does come back.
Yeah. Everybody, or at least most of the characters that we follow, are very on drugs, very on drugs.
Gorked out of their mind on spice and other things.
And then if they keep going, I mean, if they go too far, Paul's son is going to be a human worm hybrid that rules the universe for thousands of years by way of his drug poo. I genuinely do not know if movie going audiences are going to accept. I don't think will enjoy the
well,
God
so that
Emperor,
was but, that was that in Dune Messiah, or was that in God Emperor of Dune?
Yeah, so that's God Emperor. That's
okay.
It, that's because
I think they can get
going
through Dune Messiah, but I think if Denis Villeneuve tried to make God Emperor of Dune, people would be like having mental breakdowns in the theater watching this movie, like, what are we seeing right now?
So if anybody would do it, I don't know who would you trust to do God Emperor of Dune? Anybody?
No one. Literally no one. I can't think of a single human being that I would trust to make a movie version of God Emperor of Dune. I can't think of a single person that could do that right. Because that's just that okay. it definitely that is the poster for defies adaptation.
Now hear me out, the Coen brothers.
Sold. Absolutely. Well, yeah. If somebody's going to do it, it's got to be weird, right? And I mean,
right, exactly.
Yeah, I want to see John Turturro as, I don't know, Paul. I don't know, somebody. He's going to be in the movie. We know that.
Oh, John Turturro's face on a giant worm would be very good.
Yeah, yeah. Just
but
yeah.
Rolling back to the actual movie that is definitely being made, I still think that that's going to be a little bit challenging. I mean, at least in the books, they refer to it as jihad. And I think we have a different relationship with the concept of jihad these days than we did when these books are being written.
So, yeah, I mean, nobody really, I would say nobody knew what a jihad was outside of scholars of like the Arab world in, you know, the 70s. Obviously, post 9/11, that's a word that every American knows. Whether they actually know what it means or not is, you know, certainly up for debate. But the idea of like, yeah, it's a holy war, and that is definitely the application I think Frank Herbert was using in this. Like, it is very much like a holy war, and yeah, there's a lot of things about it, and it is, I think Dune Messiah is such a change from Dune in terms of the story that it's telling, that it's going to be difficult. But it could be good.
It could be. It's like you said, I think it will be difficult to see our primary characters effectively become antagonists will be a heel turn. I don't think people are going to be ready for. But
I'm looking, because I think everybody wants Timothée Chalamet to be the good guy, right? You know, and Zendaya, they're the good people, right? Oh my gosh, what's her name? Plays Lady Jessica. I was also in Silo and a bunch of other things. I cannot ever remember anybody's name. But anyway,
this podcast is going to demonstrate anything, it's that the two of us are quite bad with people's names.
Yeah, that is true. If we ever have a guest on, I'm just going to like scrawl their name all over my desk in Sharpie, like a, you know, person who is very bad at remembering things.
One question for you, because we're on topic here. What do you think about them trying to do either a mini series or a movie or something like that about the Butlerian Jihad?
I know there's something called Dune Prophecy that I don't know anything about. I assume that's like leading up to the like prophecy of the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a mini series about the Butlerian Jihad could be good, because that is definitely a great sort of setting for a sci-fi story of like a war against technology. Well, not against technology, against thinking machines. So,
sure.
Which I think is another thing that is maybe not well understood by even a lot of people who read Dune. And I've read an essay about this in terms of like its impact on the movies and the miniseries in the 80s, is that like they had computers. They just didn't have computers with actual artificial intelligence.
Sure. Or a reasonable facsimile of one.
Yeah, because that is the level of intelligence that it takes to travel through space. And so, because they do not have an artificial intelligence that can calculate that, they have the Spacing Guild, the weird fish people in tanks that are like survive on spice and can see the universe and navigate through it in their brain.
Yeah. And, I mean, look, it was the 70s. The idea of people doing enough drugs that they could bend space and time was a cool idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll figure that out someday, too.
Okay. All right. So, another sort of prediction from you from 2026. Distribution and independence.
This is something that I'm seeing, and I know my first prediction was kind of a bummer. And so I wanted to come with something that is actually like making me happy. And it's something that I think is a fairly safe prediction, because we're starting to see it already. And that is, the people who make things. So what I'm saying, when I say make things, I mean like books and video content of any kind, stories, essays, podcasts, whatever, people who create things, and particularly things about like science and science fiction, if you want to get specific, are doing them through avenues that less and less rely on sort of the corporate structures of things that have existed to allow that to happen. So there are a couple things specifically that I'm thinking of. One is, I know you know, you know this and are a fan of this as well, but there is a streaming service called Dropout, used to be College Humor, and they make a lot of content about like improv comedy and things like that, but also probably the bigger backbone of their business is a D&D / TTRPG live play series called Dimension 20, hosted by, and for the most part, by Brennan Lee Mulligan. If you listen to this podcast, there's at least a 75% chance you know who he is. And just that they have created this streaming service that is not a part of any other major corporation that is creating this really cool content. In particular right now, one thing I want to talk about is TTRPG series called Gladlands that as of recording this is currently airing, that even my wife has been watching and enjoying. I've finally gotten her into watching TTRPG live plays. But it is set in a post-apocalyptic wasteland future where everybody takes care of each other and is really nice and like sees that everybody's needs are met. And it's basically just a way of Brennan Lee Mulligan to like teach people how Praxis works, which is cool. But
so it's kind of the anti-Fallout.
Yeah, exactly. It is the anti-Fallout. That is a very good way of putting it, because there are all kinds of mutants and weird creatures and horrifying things that are actually delightful. So definitely give that a watch. The other thing, just kind of broadly speaking, like, you know, talking about Quantum, Sam Hughes, I mean, his stuff and the way that he's put it out, like, There Is No Anti-Mimetics Division is the first book that he's had an actual publishing deal for. But there are other, you know, methods that he's, you know, released his stuff. I mean, the internet, I guess if I can sum this all up, anything that comes out on the internet has the capacity, again, I think people are turning away from social media, turning away from big corporate things like YouTube and, you know, other streaming services and stuff, and creating stuff and distributing themselves because people are tired of social media algorithms telling them what they want. And I know we talked about this on YouTube specifically. Like, I unfollowed probably 75% of the people I followed on YouTube because 90% of their content was a sponsored ad read video for a robot vacuum. And I want to watch people make weird home automation stuff out of ESP32 boards, not robot vacuum review videos that are paid for by the robot vacuum companies. And there are a lot of really cool, weird people out there making really cool, weird stuff. And they're distributing their own way. So go find those people.
Yeah, the deep, deep heart of the internet has always been weird people making weird stuff for themselves and hopefully other people like it. That's kind of how things were on the early internet before everything got monetized, before we even talked about monetization a lot. I like the idea that has persisted and is maybe starting to grow again. I think there will still be the vast majority of people who are sticking with the normal stuff for a long time, maybe forever.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that there is... Yeah, there's also going to be this silo over here with us weirdos who make stuff that we like and put out in the world and hopefully other people like it.
Yeah.
I think that what we're doing right now is a really, really great manifestation of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage other people, particularly white dudes, to go out and make podcasts. There are not enough of those out there.
especially if they're talking about computers.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely not a niche that's been, you know, scratched at all.
Actually, so I think there is actually a new niche for white guys talking about computer podcasts, as long as they're not talking about the current generation of large language models all the time.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that's the other thing. I know we kind of hit those housekeeping notes up top. Two things I will guarantee any listener of this podcast: nothing that you ever hear on this podcast or from us in regards to this podcast will be generated by a large language model. Nothing, never, not ever. And the other
thing
too
is Taylor M dash. Yeah. I think you're totally right.
Yeah, this is such a great question. I'm glad that you've asked. We could talk about this question a lot because you seem to have really great ideas. No, that's never, never, ever going to be a thing. And so, you know, if there's any other reason to just have something playing on the background, that even if you don't like what we're talking about, it's that it's not made by LLMs.
That is my final sort of prediction for 2026 is, okay. And it's funny because I currently work at a company who, at least on the surface, is advertised as a big AI company. We do AI drug discovery. Back in the day, before AI became a big buzzword, they referred to it as machine learning drug discovery. And I think that's a more appropriate way of describing it. We don't ask Claude or ChatGPT what molecules to make. There's real science happening.
Have you tried, though? Just out of curiosity, have you tried? Like, what molecule should I make? I want to cure cancer. What molecule there have,
so I could, this is probably going to be an episode. I could talk about this a lot. Maybe based on my current employment, it wouldn't be a good idea, but there are plenty of large language models these days that will tell you what drugs you should try making. The problem is that they've been trained on all the data of all the drugs that have worked, and they will tell you to make a drug that is very similar to the ones that
You should make a GLP-1 drug.
So
exactly,
it's, if you figure out a way to strip all that training data out, they have, not to get too into the weeds
on this again, but like, machine learning is something that I think is good, generally speaking. Like, it is a part of computing that has the potential to do things like create drugs that cure illnesses and discover, like, I mean, using machine learning for looking at the kind of images we would get from the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, looking at MRI images of patients with cancer and seeing things that the human eye cannot. Those are all good. I remember we used to run, I think you used to run it on your PS3, and I used to run it on my little Ubuntu server, a program called Footing at Home. Yeah, that has been incredibly useful in helping discover cures for diseases. So there's good things there. It's just, it's not Claude or ChatGPT or whatever the thing Google released that makes stupid videos. I don't know.
The trouble with the current generation of large language models is that they're really, really good at making plausible text.
Yeah.
And text that you can skim over and looks pretty good.
Fancy autocorrect is what I like to say.
Right. And the extreme way of using this is something that I've encountered as part of not my job, but as the work that I do as a scientist. Occasionally I am sent a new article to review that could be published in a big journal. And I'll read it, and I will say, that doesn't quite pass the sniff test. And I will start checking references, and I will go through and cross-reference things. And it turns out that everything is wrong. Like, the whole introduction section to a paper was just made-up junk.
Yeah.
It's disheartening. It takes 1,000 times longer to check that kind of thing than it does to create it. And I use the word create loosely. Most journals these days do not have an auto reject for using these kinds of tools, to my dismay. But they do require that you disclose if you used them. Nobody does.
Of course not.
It's too bad.
I know, my wife was a college professor for a short period of time. I know in grad school you taught undergrad classes, and I have taught paramedic and EMT courses at the college level. And, man, I wouldn't want to be a teacher right now.
Yeah. So and I hate to end on a bummer here, but my prediction is that doing science is going to continue to get more challenging. With people using these machines to generate papers that aren't really real. Those of us who are in the scientific community are going to have to be on our toes and make sure that we never should take things at face value. I think that kind of vigilance is going to have to be, turned up to 11.
I think that's true for you, dear listener, with regards to your media literacy and scientific literacy. I would hope if you're listening to this podcast, you're somebody who is relatively scientifically and media literate. And that's a lot harder thing than it used to be. So do your best. Keep up the good work. And yeah, I guess to bring it back, that does sound like a pretty good topic for a podcast episode, which you will be able to listen to if we make more of these, which I think we probably will. On that note, Lucas, where can people find you?
Oh, boy. You can find me. Where can you find me?
At his home in California. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes. If you're in the if you're east of Los Angeles, you can find me walking around. No,
just walking down the I-5, like in disheveled clothes, you know.
Yes. And with a shotgun on my back, looking for
the AI.
Shoot.
Yes. It was the AI. They did this to me.
No, you can find me at Lucas E. Moore on various social media services, except for the one that used to be good and is now bad. You can also find me at lucasmoore.net. I write stuff sometimes. Taylor, where can you be found?
You can find me on Blue Sky at taylorsloan.me. And that is also my website, taylorsloan.me. You can find the things that I occasionally write when I am not taking care of a baby, and that is why I haven't written as much, if you're wondering. And as far as the podcast goes, you can find this podcast, you probably already have, on iTunes and other podcasting platforms as we add them. You can find the podcast at Blue Sky. It's going to be Sci and or Fi at bluesky.com. I think that's how that works. I should have looked that up first. Whatever, just type in science and or fiction on Blue Sky. You'll find us.
Yeah.
We're also on Instagram for now until
the new
that
fun one
becomes horrible. And we are not. If you get one of those weird ads that say that we've joined Meta AI, I promise you we have not. They're lying to you. Don't click the button. They'll steal your soul. But yeah, that'll wrap it up for us here at Science and or Fiction. I'm Taylor Sloan.
I'm Lucas Moore. We'll talk to you next time. That went pretty good.